Well, last week we were in chapter 14. We got to 5 verses because there was a lot there. Lord willing, we're going to finish the chapter, but let's get a running start at it. Let's start with verse 1. I'll read verses 1 through 5 quickly. At the last part of the great tribulation, that 7-year, 70th week of Daniel, all the nations of the world are now flocking to Jerusalem. All the armies, every people now is unified under one singular thought: kill all of the Jews. Why do you think that is? Because the devil, in this case, who is demon-possessed, a human, the Antichrist, he is trying his very best to make the book of Revelation null and void. And if I can kill all the humans and destroy utterly Jerusalem, well, then how could the book of Revelation then come true? And in classic form, the Lord says, you just do your best there, devil. And everything you do, every move you plan, is going to work right into my purposes. So that's what's happened. We are now just in front of Revelation chapter 19. The book of Revelation has run its course. 7 seals, 7 trumpets, 7 bowls. And now all the nations of the world are gathered against Jerusalem. That's what we looked at last week. Verse 1, one more time. And the day of the Lord is coming, when your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against you, against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city will go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. So it seems that God himself at this point is fighting and moving through half of the city and the people of Jerusalem. Perhaps we could call them the IDF. I don't know. The Israeli Defense Forces. Verse 3. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations that are surrounding Jerusalem as he fights in the day of battle. Last week I showed you several occasions when he has done that before. Verse 4. And in that day, his feet, Jesus, Messiah. As I said last week, all the rabbis know that this is speaking of Messiah. We just happen to know who that Messiah is. On that day, Jesus' feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. Write Revelation 19. Here he comes, which faces Jerusalem on the east. That's the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives will split in two from the east to the west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain will be moved or shoved to the north, and half of it shoved to the south. Got some pictures for you. In 1964, that was a long time ago, wasn't it? Sheraton Hotel Company was about to build a hotel there on the Mount of Olives because it's a great place to look at the old city of Jerusalem. But the project had to be shifted south several meters. Why? You know what they found underneath their site? In fact, I got some pictures. Go ahead, Blakey, if you would. This is the Sheraton Hotel. It's not Sheraton anymore, but it was back then. It's today called the Seven Arches Hotel there in Jerusalem. It's on the Mount of Olives. I've been there. Hit the go button. Beautiful structure. Look at that, you guys. You are is facing west. That is on the Mount of Olives. And when you walk around where that tent structure is, and there's a little parking lot area to the one side, you have a breathtaking view of the old Jerusalem. But there, falling away to the left, that's the Mount of Olives into the Kidron Valley. Now, when it's lunchtime, you get to eat here. Go. Look at that place. Can you see in the middle window, if you have really good eyes? The middle window down to the right, that is the Dome of the Rock. That is what the top of the Mount of Olives looks like. Let's go again. That is the view from the parking lot or the porch or porticature of the Seven Arches Hotel. Is that a crazy cool way to look at Mount Moriah and the Temple Mount? That's the Dome of the Rock, of course, to the center, right center, and then Aloxa to the left. And that's the Kidron Valley that's falling away at your feet. Hit or go button. Let's go into a satellite. Now we're looking down on the area. Go. There is the Dome of the Rock. Go. There is the Seven Arches Hotel. Go. See that empty space to its north? That's where the hotel was supposed to go in the year 1964, but they couldn't because they did their geological studies, as you do. It's going to be quite a facility, so you better make sure that the foundation is going to be set in the right spot. So their geological team surveyed the Mount of Olives under the circle, and guess what they found? A significant and deep crack in the rocks. Go. And I've sort of meandered a line there, but that's where it is. What we've just read in Zechariah chapter 14, that when the time is right, that fissure is going to crack open. That's a fault line, a major fault line, and it goes east and west, just like Zechariah said. Hey, was Zechariah a plate tectonics geologist? Nope, but God knew what he was talking about. So you see the up arrow, the north is going to crack and move up. The south is going to crack and move down. And that is going to open up a great big valley. Now, we're going to see here in a minute that this valley is going to then facilitate a river that is going to also spring up under what will be Jerusalem's new messianic temple. Now, before we go there, while we got this cool vision, hit the go button. See the yellow square? Take it away real fast. Hit the up arrow. Gone. That is the Wailing Wall Plaza. Let's put it back. There it is. That is the Wailing Wall Plaza. And that wall to the right is the Wailing Wall. That's the last portion of Herod's temple that was not destroyed by the Romans. And why is it so important to the Jews, the Wailing Wall? Because they are hoping and praying for the time where they will get their temple built. That'll be the third temple. Solomon's temple was the first. Herod's temple is largely regarded as the second. And then the third temple is going to be facilitated by the Antichrist himself. Where is it going to go? Nobody really knows for sure. But here's where I think it's going to go. Go ahead. Right there. When the church is gone in the form of the rapture, I believe that Psalm 83 battle is somewhere right around. My personal hunch is the church is taken away. Nobody is praying against the spirit of Antichrist that 1 John tells us about. And so the Antichrist is going to begin to do his thing. I believe that the battle of Psalm 83 kicks off, and we've got teachings on that. If that's interesting to you, nukes fly. Amman, Jordan is a ruinous heap, and so is Damascus. I believe it is at that point when the Antichrist steps up and says, I'll take care of this. Well, why wouldn't America want to do something like that? We know that the Antichrist is going to come genetically. He is going to come from the old Roman Empire, or politically perhaps. Why is America not figured prominently in the book of Revelation and end times prophecy? Because aren't we the big guy on the block right now? Well, yeah, but I believe that the rapture will affect America more than any other nation. I believe that there is going to be tens of millions, I hope more, but millions and millions of Christians are going to suddenly disappear and be caught up with the Lord into the air. Do you remember 9/11 in the year 2001? 3,000 Americans, or people working in America, certainly were suddenly gone. Did you know that it basically set into motion a multi-year recession that was felt throughout the entire world? Because it happened there in New York specifically, in all the financial centers there headquartered in the Twin Towers, 3,000, the departure suddenly of 3,000 people sent ripples throughout the financial world that took years to resolve. So a lot of people don't know that. Well, what if in America tens of millions of people suddenly disappear? I personally believe that when the rapture happens, the nation that will feel its effect mostly is going to be America. And so many in our military, so many in our government, so many engineers and people who keep the trains moving and the lights on and the water systems rolling. I personally believe that America will be so reeling from the sudden disappearance of tens of millions of important people that they will be consumed with their own domestic challenges. I believe that that opens the door for a European potentate to come to the fore, and he does. Psalm 83, I believe, happens. He steps up and he says, Israel, stop. Because in the battle of Psalm 83, Israel first attacked, launches a counterattack, and is thrusting into Egypt almost all the way to the Nile River. Eastward, pressing all the way almost to the river Euphrates. And to stop them, it would seem that the Antichrist says, stop this advancement. And they say, we have to do this because these people attacked us and they'll do it again. We have to build for us reinforceable areas where they cannot cross. I believe the Antichrist says, I will guarantee your peace. I will guarantee your peace. They'll have to come through me to get you. I guarantee 7 years of protection. And as a carrot, I believe he will solve the messy political problem. Right now, would the Jews even tolerate on their Temple Mount, near their temple, what they would consider the abomination of the Dome of the Rock to the north and the Al-Aqsa Mosque to the south? Not now. But remember, they're going to think that he is Messiah. The book of Thessalonians says when he shows up, he's also doing miracles. So the whole world is going, who is this guy? He's going to say, I'm your Messiah. And I will guarantee your peace. And I know exactly where Solomon's temple was and Herod's temple was and the exact rock that Abraham offered Isaac on because I was there. And because of his supernatural miracles, he will point, I believe, to that blue section. Hit the go button if you would. There it is, that idea, or I should say that perspective from the Mount of Olives. Go. I believe the Antichrist temple is going to go right there. I don't know. We'll see. Some people believe it's going to go to the north of the Dome of the Rock, but there's a number of reasons I don't believe so, mainly that the new east gate has to be in a certain place in proximity to the Mount of Olives. I believe the Antichrist is going to get the temple built right there. Do you see that currently there are no structures in that area? Another indication that I believe it's going to be right there, along with the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, not having to knock them over, because would the Islamic world take that as a terrible affront? Of course they would. But another thing that's happening after the church is gone is that the ecumenical movement of let's all get along as one great religion. I've also done a study on the combatants of Psalm 83, and those regions currently are largely what are called Shia or Shiite Muslims. They have a certain worldview that they can't take nothing from nobody, and they are very militant, as you well know. That is currently who is in Iran, the regime in Iran. But it's the Shia Muslims who are most wanting to make war. I believe that the Psalm 83 battle, those nations mentioned there, largely incapacitate the Shia Muslims. Well, then who does that leave? The Sunni Muslims. Saudi Arabia. They also have an end of the world sort of understanding, but they are way more amenable to make treaties and contracts. You may have heard of the Abraham Accords with Israel, is Saudi Arabia. I believe that the ecumenical movement that the Antichrist is going to get rolling with his miracles, he is going to point to some place on the Temple Mount. I believe it's right there. And the Jews are going to say, well, if you're the Messiah and we're here, then we trust you. And I believe that the building of the third temple in Israel next door to the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque is going to be a huge, let's all kumbaya, get along in a worldwide peace movement. No more Muslims, no more Christians, no more Jews, as it were, in their current sort of understanding. We are all going to get along. I believe that is going to start the seven-year Great Tribulation. And that's why I believe that that's where the third temple is going to be built. Can't say for sure. Now, just on the other side, see those trees within the circle on the upper part of that little circle? What's right directly on the other side of those trees? That's the Wailing Wall. I think it is interesting the Antichrist could say, you, since 1948, Jewish people have been praying in the right direction of your temple the whole time. I think that'll be a powerful incentive for them to believe him and build the third temple. And by the way, remember, that is the stopwatch that starts the 70th week of Daniel, the peace treaty with Antichrist. Now we know there's going to be 1,260 days of two witnesses in Jerusalem, followed by 144,000 Jewish evangelists for the second half for 1,260 days. Everybody okay? Let's keep cruising. Now tonight, let me finish. Verse 5 again. And then you, Jerusalem, people in Jerusalem, will flee through my mountain valley. I believe that is also referred to as the Valley of Jehoshaphat, Joel chapter 3, verse 2. For the mountain valley shall reach Azal, and nobody knows where that is. Yes, you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. We looked at that last week. I hope you have in your margin Amos 1 verse 1, which mentions that earthquake. And thus the Lord my God will come and all the saints with you. We know that as Revelation 19 verses 11 through 21. And I also believe that as all the armies of the world are fighting to the death just east of this location, really over the next mountain range, which falls away to the valley of Megiddo. In Hebrew, valley is Har Megiddo. How do we say it today? Armageddon. I wonder, and I can't say for sure, I wonder if that huge battle of all the armies that originally came against Jerusalem, they begin to fight each other in the valley just over the hill. So from this picture, you're standing on the Mount of Olives, you are facing west, so behind you, over the next mountain pass, falls away to the Valley of Armageddon. And just like what happened in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, they all arrive to try to beat up on the Jews, but then God allows them to become paranoid, and then they begin to fight each other and hack each other to pieces. That is a dress rehearsal, I believe, for the Valley of Armageddon. Now, are there nukes involved? I believe there are, because I'm going to show you some rather startling language. And if there are nukes that have flown nearby, or certainly within the region, what happens when the equivalent of thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of pounds of TNT-like force explode just above the surface of the earth? It blows into the atmosphere tons of dirt and debris. Have you ever heard of the term of a nuclear winter? That's one of the challenges. Would there be so much debris into the atmosphere that it actually is shading out the sun, its warmth and energy? We know that that's a possibility in a nuclear war. Will we see, and does Zechariah describe that? Watch this. Verse 6 now. It shall come to pass in that day that there will be no light. Now he's going to expand. Well, what I mean is the light will diminish. Verse 7. It shall be one day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night. So it's not blackness, but it's not exactly daytime, and it's not exactly nighttime. But at evening time, it shall happen that it will be light. Let me read to you from another translation, I think sheds a little more light on the subject. The typical sources of light will no longer shine, yet there will be some kind of continuous light. Only the Lord knows how it's going to happen. And at that time, there will be no normal day or night, is what this other translation says. Do you remember in Revelation chapter 1, John sees the resurrected Jesus there on the beach or the shore there on Patmos. One of his descriptions was interesting. He said, looking at Jesus, the resurrected Lord, was like looking into the noonday sun. Remember that? Now think with me. If the Battle of Armageddon has caused regional nuclear winter, because just over the mountain, all of the armies in the world are going at it, does the returned, resurrected Jesus, remember his foot stepped on the footprint, his pressure of his footprint cracks the mountain in half. When he shows up, returned and resurrected, is Jesus' light emanating from him? Is that what this peculiar light is amid this bizarre, not quite night, not quite day? Until the massive debris cloud dissipates? It's an interesting idea. And by the way, do we ever see that Jesus' face lights other things? Yeah. How about the new Jerusalem? It's a model, I believe, here in Zechariah 14. It's a model of what happens in the new Jerusalem. Let me read to you Revelation 21, verse 23. And the city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated. And the Lamb, Jesus, is the light. Real quickly, and we're going back in the Wayback Machine. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Cool. Genesis 1, verse 1. And then God said, let there be light. And there was light. Cool. Wait a minute. The sun and the moon have not been created yet. That's a couple days away. Question. How could there be light without stars or combustive anything? What was the light that God illuminated suddenly his vast creation with? I believe it is the Shekinah glory of God that lit everything before the sun and the moon were created. I believe that. And I believe that the New Jerusalem is lit in the same capacity. It's going to go back to be lit by the Shekinah glory of God again. Verse 8. And in that day, or the beginning of the millennial reign, it shall be that living waters shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea. You can write the Dead Sea. And half of them toward the western sea. You can write Mediterranean Sea. Now this is weird. In both summer and winter it shall occur. What river is this? Mark in your margin here. Ezekiel 47, verses 1 through 13. We have some time. Let's actually look at it. Hold your finger here in Zechariah. Go to the left and go to Ezekiel chapter 47. Ezekiel 47. You want to see a videotape of this river? Here it is. Chapter 47, Ezekiel, verse 1. Then he brought me, Ezekiel, back to the door of the temple. Now, this isn't just any old temple. Ezekiel is looking at the millennial temple of Jesus. So he brought me back to that temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple. Really? By the way, which direction does the door of the temple always face? When God told Moses to build the tabernacle, he told it always the front door to face east. So this temple, Solomon's temple, Herod's temple, and now this temple is also facing east. So if it's facing east, which mountain is it facing? The Mount of Olives. Flowing from underneath the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the front of the temple faced east. And the water was flowing from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. Verse 2. And he, the Lord, brought me, Ezekiel, out by the way of the north gate. And he led me on the outside of the outer gateway that faces east. And there was water running out of the right side. Verse 3. And when the man went out to the east and the line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits. That's about a quarter of a mile, actually. And he brought me through the waters, and it came up to my ankles. So when it first leaves the temple, it's not too deep, only about ankle deep. Verse 4. Again, he measured 1,000 cubits, about a quarter of a mile, and brought me through the waters. And this time, the water came up to my knees. So it's getting deeper. And again, he measured 1,000, and he brought me through the water, came up to my waist. What's happening is Ezekiel is going downstream in this river that Zechariah said is going to flow through that crack that I showed you. It's on its way toward the Dead Sea. Verse 5. Again, he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not cross, for the river was too deep, water in which one must swim. A river that could not be crossed, verse 6. And he said to me, Son of man, did you see it? And then he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river. And when I returned there along the bank of the river were many trees on one side and on the other, verse 8. And then he said to me, this water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the valley. Right, your margin there, Zechariah chapter 14, valley. That's the one, verse 5, I believe. 14, verse 5. And enters the sea. What sea? Well, to us currently, it's the Dead Sea. Why is it dead? It's the lowest place on the planet, so water rolls in it over, 7 tons a day of water rolls in, but it's low, it can't drain out. It is a river running into it, but no river roaring out of it. So the sun evaporates the H2O, leaving salts and sediments behind. That's why it's dead, because it is 30 times saltier than the ocean. Nothing can live there except a strange species of brine shrimp. That's it. That's why it's dead. So if it's going to live again, I believe that the major earthquakes talked about in the book of Revelation and other locations, I believe that everything is rocking and rolling. I believe the crack is also a part. It got weakened in the great earthquakes in Revelation chapter, 16, and some of those other locations. That's the earthquake that is so powerful that the birds in the air get airsick and the fish in the sea get seasick. And not one wall remains. Read that. Not one human structure. Would that include the pyramids? I think it might. How powerful is that earthquake? What's happening? I believe God is allowing the great big plates that now run most of our earthquakes and such. I believe he's re-cracking them. And now what's happening is the highest mountains are being shaken down. The Bible says that all the islands disappear. Those would be mountains in the ocean. I believe that God is re-rattling all the topography of the planet. And Everest is shaken down to an average level. And you know what becomes the highest mountain on the planet? That one, Moriah, that Jesus is going to build his temple on. The Bible says in the book of Isaiah that Israel's Jerusalem is going to be the temple of the Lord is going to be the highest mountain on the planet. Well, back to here. We're back in Ezekiel 47. Look at verse 8 again. It's going to flow into the valley. And now you know where that is. Zechariah 14. And enter the sea, the Dead Sea, which reaches the sea, the Dead Sea. Its waters are healed. God is going to raise the basin of the Dead Sea, and water is now going to roll in and out. And it shall be that every living thing that moves, wherever the rivers go, will live. That's a powerful sort of metaphor in action, that the Dead Sea is going to live in the millennial reign. And there will be a very great multitude of fish. No fish there now, because these waters go there. For they will be healed, and everything will live wherever the river goes. I've circled goes in my Bible and written in the margin flows. Put your Jesus glasses on. If Jesus is constantly pouring in to us, but we're not pouring out, is there a possibility that we could get all dried up inside? I think that's a powerful imagery. Jesus, pour in, we ask and seek in worship and prayer and the Bible, of course. But if we're not giving out those truths that we're learning, then we're going to be like the Dead Sea. You need a river. Let the river flow. Verse 10. And it shall be that fishermen will stand by it from En Gedi, which is the northern part of the Dead Sea currently, to En Galim, which is likely in the southern portion of the Dead Sea. There will be places for spreading their nets. Their fish will be the same kinds of the fish of the Great Sea, meaning the Mediterranean, exceedingly many. Verse 11, but it's still going to have some swamps and some marshes that won't be healed. Why? They're going to be given over to salt because they're going to be places of stagnation. Again, keep your Jesus glasses on. Verse 12, and on the bank of the river, on this side and on that, will grow all kinds of trees used for food. Their leaves will not wither, and their fruit will not fail. This is, I believe, an indication that in the millennial reign, we probably will have some semblance of seasons, but nothing as severe as they are now. It would seem that the growing time in the millennial reign is all the time. This might be one of the indicators right here in the book of Ezekiel. They will not wither, their fruit will not fail, they will bear fruit every month. Would that be January? Yeah. Because their water flows from the sanctuary, and their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for medicine. Back to the book of Zechariah. Well, there's that river. And now you know where it's going and how it originates. Back to Zechariah 14. We're now in verse 9. All right. So, in the millennial reign, verse 9. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. And in that day, the millennial reign, it shall be, the Lord is one, and his name one. How will the Dead Sea live again after the huge earthquakes? The Dead Sea will no longer be the lowest place on the earth. We're going to have a flow in and a flow out. Watch. Now, verse 10, more description. All the land shall be turned into a plain from Geba, which is the northern border. That's in Joshua 21, verse 17. Joshua 21, verse 17. To Ramon, which is south of Jerusalem. You can read about that in Joshua 15, verse 32. Why Joshua? Because these are the places that Joshua gives the 12 tribes of Israel after they get into the promised land. And Jerusalem shall be raised up. I wrote my margin, yeah, literally. In fact, write Isaiah 2, verse 2. Let me read it to you. It shall come to pass that in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house, that place right there, currently Mount Moriah, shall be established on the top of the mountains. It'll be the tallest one. And shall be exalted above all the hills, and all the nations will flow to it. I wrote, Mount Everest won't be there anymore. And after all those earthquakes, planet Earth's topography will be averaged more evenly. And Jerusalem shall be raised up. And inhabited in her place from Benjamin's gate. For you Bible students, if you want to run that down, this is Jeremiah 37, verse 13. And the northern wall of the old city of Jerusalem, it was Benjamin's gate that was the farthest east, if you will, the northeastern corner. So from there to the place of the first gate and the corner gate. That's on the western wall, northernmost of the old city. And from the Tower of Hananel, that's Nehemiah 3, verse 1. That is the northern wall's westmost gate. To the king's wine press. We know that was on the other side, the southern side of the south wall. Kind of what he's saying is, from north to south, east to west, the entire city of Jerusalem is going to be literally the highest place on the planet. Verse 11. The people shall dwell in it, and no longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. The Antichrist and the nearby battle there in the Valley of Megiddo have greatly damaged Jerusalem, I believe, including destroying whatever the Antichrist builds in that location, I believe gets knocked down. And I don't think it's going to be there anymore. Jesus is going to have to rebuild it. Well, actually, you know what? His statue stays put, doesn't it? In the Holy of Holies for 30 more days. So maybe it doesn't get completely destroyed. Well, anyway, Jesus is going to rebuild it, including his temple. And I want to show you some slides on that. Are you ready, Blake? Let me show you what we're talking about. Go ahead. Here is a beautiful artist's rendition of the tabernacle of Moses. It measured 150 cubits by 100 cubits, and so it's very small. And you can see the human and the cow there for reference. Solomon, he is going to rebuild the simple tabernacle of God as prescribed to Moses. I can do it better. So he builds this. Go ahead. Bigger, better, stronger, faster, taller, cooler. And he puts gold everywhere. And no longer is the house of God underneath shoe leather. That's what humans do. Yeah, we got to gussy up for God. And what did God say? Don't gussy up my house. And in fact, where you see where the ramp is, the stone altar, one of the prescriptions is the stones that you raise it on, do not bring tools against it. Don't shape it into fancy whatever. I want rocks, round, jagged old rocks to put the altar on. Isn't it funny when humans get a hold of the building committee for God? They build stuff like, oh, I don't know, St. Peter's Basilica or other places. God says, don't do that. Well, Solomon says, but God, I got money. Let's build you a big one. So he does. Well, that's going to get destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And then what's going to happen is, after their exile in 70 years in Babylon, they come back under Ezra and Nehemiah, and they build a humble sort of artifice. And some of the old-timers are all, what a beauty little temple. So when Herod comes up, he starts roughly about 40 or so B.C., he's going to rechange and reshape the entire Temple Mount, and he builds this. Go ahead. Here's Herod's temple. It was magnificent. They were still working on it when Jesus was there. Jesus dies 32 A.D., and they don't finish the thing for another 20, 30 years. And finally, roughly about the year or two, they get it finished there. Rome destroys it. Isn't that just like God? You humans are pretty excited about your buildings. Not so much me. I don't care. People go into a structure like that, and they're all, look at the building. I don't want them to look at human ingenuity. I want them to look at the simplicity. I bring in your animal sacrifices. Innocent blood flowing should pose a question in your mind. Why is this innocent lamb bleeding and dying for my sin? It doesn't seem fair. Because when Jesus is dying on the cross, what is every Jewish person supposed to think? Oh, that's why. Jesus is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Well, you see that all got lost in how humans like to build things. So roughly about the year or so they got finished building it, not too long after, the Romans knock it all down and it gets destroyed. Well, then, as I said, the third temple, the temple that the Antichrist is going to make, gets built, and then that's going to be destroyed. And by the time Jesus gets done, all the dimensions of Jesus' tabernacle are all here in the book of Ezekiel, chapters 40 to the end. You want to get a look at what it looks like? Go. It is huge. And it is somehow fit on the Mount Moriah. Now, some of you are going, didn't you just tell us about that whole building thing? Yeah, there's one glaring difference from Solomon's temple and Herod's temple to this one. And you know what it is? That Jesus himself is there. Oh. So then you don't get sort of overwhelmed by the buildings because you're looking into Jesus' actual face. Now see there, the artist has depicted a little blue squiggle, and that's the river that we just looked at in the book of Ezekiel and also in Zechariah. Look at the size of that bad boy. That's pretty cool, isn't it? Pretty amazing. What do I have next, Blake? I can't remember. Oh yeah, here it is. Here is a scale version of all of them next to one another. See the football field in the bottom right? The tabernacle in black, that's how big it was. Solomon's temple, you see there in brown, and in gold or goldenrod, that was Herod's temple. Look how big Jesus' millennial reign temple will be. And the huge difference is Jesus himself is there every day. All right, let's dive in, and I think we're going to move quickly to the end. Jerusalem, verse 10, is going to be raised up and inhabited in her places from Benjamin's gate, the place of the first gate, the corner gate, from the tower of Hananel, the king's winepress, really from north to south, east to west, and it's going to be lifted up. Verse 11, the people are going to dwell in it. No longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. Verse 12, and this shall be the plague with which the Lord shall strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem. So, kind of, again, revisiting the end of the last portion of the book of Revelation, I should say the Great Tribulation, something peculiar is going to happen to all those combatants that are going to come against Jerusalem. Watch this. Well, their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet. That word for dissolve in Hebrew means it will be runny and run down. Their feet, their eyes shall run out of their sockets, and their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths. Woo! What kind of ailment is that? Interestingly enough, if you know much about thermonuclear explosions and severe and significant radiation poisoning, they are strikingly similar. I believe nukes have flown. I believe that radiation poisoning is probably what this is describing. If so, wouldn't that be a technology statement? How would Zechariah know how to describe a neutron bomb? Fascinating. There was no such weapon in Zach's day. Also, too, you'll notice that the book of Revelation talks about horses. In the valley of Armageddon, the blood spatters to the horse's bridle. Well, Pastor Steve, wouldn't there be mechanized infantry and such in a real modern-day war in a current theater? Well, there would be, unless thermonuclear or nuclear devices, what do they always explode in one of those devices? An electromagnetic pulse, an EMP pulse. Is it possible that a couple explosions or airbursts nearby, what would that do to any unshielded circuitry of automobiles, helicopters, and airplanes? It would render them what? Completely dead. And how are you going to get around a battlefield if you don't have your motor and car? You then grab a what? A horse. Fascinating. Verse 13. It shall come to pass in that day that a great panic from the Lord will be among them. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand. This is describing hand-to-hand combat. It's happening likely in the Valley of Armageddon. It's also happening somewhere probably near Jerusalem. And is that why some of the people flee from Jerusalem through that valley? Probably. Verse 14. Well, anyway, Judah, if you will, the IDF, they're also going to be fighting at Jerusalem. And the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be gathered together, gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance. This happens, by the way, when people come against Israel. Have you noticed that when God basically steps up and fights back? Like in the case of Egypt when they left in Exodus chapter 12, what did the Egyptians give to the exiting Jewish people? Tons of gold and silver and jewels. I like to call that 400 years of back pay because they had been treated as slaves, remember. Also in 2 Chronicles 20, there was a similar battle, armies coming against Israel, and then they hack each other to pieces. It took 3 days for the people of Israel to collect all the spoil from those fallen armies. All the armies of the world are in this battle, and when they die, what are they going to have in their pockets? It would seem lots of riches. Jesus' glasses on. God sees to it that everything and every time the enemy comes at you, don't panic. Trust his word. Move in his promises, and I too will reap the riches, if you will, of acquired faith, insight, and wisdom for your next battle. Let's finish up. Zoom to the end, verse 15. Such also will be the plague. I believe that's radiation poisoning. For the horses and the mules and on the camels and the donkeys and all the cattle that will be in those camps around Jerusalem, most likely in the Valley of Armageddon, so shall this plague be. Verse 16, and it shall come to pass that everyone who was left of all the nations will come that came against Jerusalem after the Battle of Armageddon. Remember, Jesus is going to separate the sheep and the goats. Remember that? And I believe that there are going to be many people in the midst of even the Battle of Armageddon who are going to recognize, I think those 144,000 Jewish evangelists were right. Probably everyone who's in this battle has encountered one of those 144,000. And don't forget also, there's an angel flying across the sky broadcasting the gospel. There are going to be those people from those nations that are going to have a change of heart, and they are going to ask for God's forgiveness. That's what's being mentioned here. Because only the true believers are going to go into the millennial reign. Well, anyway, some of those people that got saved shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the feasts of tabernacles. I think I have one more slide, Blake. It's this one, yeah. There's the millennial reign temple of Jesus. It's going to be a functioning temple. You mean they're going to have animal sacrifices? Uh-huh. But in the before Jesus, from Moses on to 70 AD, those sacrifices were in fact atonement, which means a covering. The sacrifices in the millennial reign are going to be commemorative. Before Jesus rebuilds planet Earth in the millennial reign, all animal sacrifices were an atonement or a covering for sin. In the millennial reign, those sacrifices are, remember what sin used to require? It's going to be a reminder. That's why they're still going to be having animal sacrifices there in the new Jesus' millennial reign temple. Now watch this, verse 16. It shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which come against Jerusalem shall go up year to worship the king in that location, the Lord of hosts, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Circle that and write in your margin, Matthew 17, verse 4. Matthew 17, verse 4. Remember when they're on the Mount of Transfiguration, I believe that God opens up a time bubble, I believe. The description that the gospel writers give of Jesus is, man, he looked really different. And he glowed huge brightness from the inside out. And there was Moses and Elijah standing right next to him. And what does Peter say? Whoa, this is awesome. Hey, Lord, let us build three what? Booths, tabernacles. Why? Because from this verse, rabbis taught that in the millennial reign or the kingdom age of Messiah, the Feast of Tabernacles will still be observed. Peter, a well-taught Jewish young man, could have sworn this must be the millennial reign. Can you blame him? Look at Jesus glowing. Look at Moses and Elijah. That's why he said, Lord, let's build three booths. Because Peter thought that is the millennial reign. And what do you do in the millennial reign? You celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. Verse 17, it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the king, Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. There is rain in the millennium, by the way. You can mark in your margin Isaiah 32, verse 19. But it's a very different rain. It'll never be torrential. All atmospheric precipitation, even hail, is going to be gentle and not harmful. For those who don't come to Jerusalem for tabernacles, I don't want to go. They're in disobedience. So God withholds rain from their region. Verse 18. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations. Is this radioactivity? I don't think so. This may be something else entirely. I don't know. A lot of these, remember, as a rule, Bible prophecy is not for us to predict the future. Bible prophecy is for when it's actually happening, the people are going, hey, look at that, it's in the Bible. But as we're getting closer and closer to these events, have you noticed that the prophetic picture is clarified? So I don't know what this particular plague is. Those that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, verse 19, this shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus glasses on. Have you ever noticed? When I forsake the gathering of ourselves together at the church, have you ever noticed you get a little dryness in your soul? Interesting. Verse 20. And in that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horses. The pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. In other words, there's not going to be secular and spiritual. What this is saying is every aspect of every common day life is holy. Verse 21, yes, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness to the Lord of hosts. Everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them. This idea of a worshipful heart, a Jesus or Messiah-focused mindset, won't be just for Sundays. The holy and the common are going to be all dedicated to the Lord every day, all the time. And there will be no such thing as this is secular and that's spiritual. All things are dedicated to loving God. And in that day, there shall no longer be a Canaanite, if you will, a merchandiser, in the house of the Lord of hosts. What this saying is, in the millennial reign, false teachers will be quickly recognized and judged. I'll give you two verses where it says that. Isaiah 30, verse 20. Let me read it to you. Isaiah 30, verse 20. Your teachers will not be moved into corner anymore. As your eyes shall see, you'll know the right ones from the wrong ones. Also, Isaiah 66, verse 14. His, or millennial reign Jesus, his hand of provision, known to his servants, and his indignation, known to his enemies. Have you ever noticed that the devil has always used wolves in sheep's clothing and false prophets with great effect? In the millennial reign, remember, Lucifer and his demons, they're incarcerated. They're not messing with the humans. And between us new body believers, whose mind is greatly expanded, we're teaching the humans every day. And also the Bible says in the book of Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 14, that the knowledge of God will cover the earth like a sea. It's Bible studies all the time. There's going to be no merchandisers, no posers in God's house. But one last little thought. Write these two verses down, would you? Zephaniah, Z-E-P-H, Zephaniah 13, verses 4 and 5. Also, Zechariah 13, verses 4 and 6. Everybody is going to behave themselves. Everyone is going to be performing ordinances and worship. But those two verses say there will still be rebellious haters of God in the millennial reign. Can you believe that? How perfect is the atmosphere? Perfect. You don't have to go to Walmart because everything you need is right outside of your door. Every man lives under his own vine. Perfect justice. Jesus on the planet. The weather is perfect. Everything is in perfect equilibrium. And still there will be people who hate God. But they're going to cover it up within them. They're going to hide it. Even though they're rebellious haters of God in the millennial reign, they're going to perform everything. But the second Satan is released in Revelation 20, he raises an army from those. But there won't be very many, right? How many, you guys? As the sands of the sea.